The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 2nd of June, 2020. I'm in Tanunda, in the house of Roddy Clonick. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Roddy, for agreeing to participate in this program, The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. Could you just please, to start things off, could you please state your full name, date of birth, and your service number, please?
Roderick Frank Kleinig, R-O-D-R-I-C-K.
And your date of birth?
August the 13th, 1923.
And your service number, please?
PA-3116.
Now, would you be able to share, please, Roddy, just some information about where you were born and maybe a little bit about your childhood and your family, please?
Born in at St. Kitts on August the 13th, 1923. And we lived on a farm, which my father had inherited from his father. And I was the fifth child of 11 children, 7 girls and 4 boys. And twin sisters.
What was it like living in such a large family?
We were living on the farm and we had no telephones or radios or anything in those days in the 30s, in the 20s and 30s, and we had to make our own entertainment and that. My sister Margaret learned to play the piano and we used to sing of a weekend. We had a teacher at St. Kitts by the name of Edward Francis Farrell, and he was a staunch Catholic in amongst all Lutherans. But he was a great teacher. He taught grade 1 to 7. There's about 30 odd children in the school. And of a weekend, Mum used to invite him around to our place, and he was very musical and he played the piano as well, and we used to sing songs and that, you see.
Can you recall any of the songs that you used to sing?
Well, we had a lot of, sang a lot of songs from Gilbert and Sullivan and all those things we learned at school. And we used to put on a concert every year with him, and you know, and that went on for quite a number of years. And when I passed grade 7 grade 7, had to go to Truro to sit and do the grade 7 exams, you know, which I passed. And I was 12. And that was the early 30s when the big depression was on. And Dad couldn't manage the farm, wasn't big enough to sustain us all. My sisters went out working, and my eldest brother went out working. And he had to sell the farm in the end because we just couldn't maintain the family anymore. So he sold it in 1935.
How did you feel having to leave the farm?
Well, we were children and I mean, it didn't make much difference to us. I mean, but Dad, it affected him. We went and lived at Williston down Gawler for 12 months. And Dad had a nervous breakdown because he had that farm given him by his father and he had to go into a receiving home in town. I can remember going down with my mother and visiting him. He was there for about 3 months. In the meantime, my eldest brother went around with his auctioneer or elders crowd and we bought a dairy at Angaston. It was... We had milked the cows by hand and delivered them by horse and cart twice a day
So you were at school at this stage?
I was in my last, when we shifted from Williston to Angaston, I was in grade 7. And my mother said to me, "Roddy, this was in May, when you be 13 in August, you're allowed to leave school and you'll have to come home and help Dad because he'll need someone to help him, to support him." So I left school at 13 and I stayed at home and helped my father on the farm and brought him back again in good health and that. So we used to deliver milk twice a day, 7 days a week. I can remember those days. I used to go on bike with a billy and we had a half a pint measure and delivered the milk. And then we were pretty sporty. I used to play footy and after footy, you had to go home and milk the cows and hold the milk around.
Did you play footy for?
Angaston.
Angaston.
Yeah, and my brothers, he had a job then, and my eldest sister, they got married, and then the war broke out in 1939, and in 1942, I was 18, and I joined the Navy. And the girls did the milk round. Well, my eldest brother was in the Army, and the girls did the milk round while we were away. After the war, when I got home in 1946, I was in the Navy nearly 4 years. I went and helped them on the milk round. Of course, the girls had gone off nursing sisters, and then I said to Dad, "Well, look, we were hand milking. We had plenty of work, hands to milk. Now with only you and I and one other one, we'll have to get milking machines." And no, Dad said, "Look, I don't feel like carrying on anymore. I'm getting older." And the next door neighbour said to me, "Look, Roddy, if you buy the milk off of me, I'll take over and buy your cows and the land and you can carry on the milk round," which I did. So I used to buy the milk off of him and do the milk round on my own at that time. In the meantime, I got married in 1948 with my wife up there.
This is 1948?
Yeah. And that's the one before is at when we were engaged, the other one photo, but about 18 months before that.
And your wife's name was?
Was Rosalind MacLeod. She was the daughter of the quiet stockman who was a character in We of the Never Never. That's me.
So this photograph here is about 42?
Yes, when I first joined the Navy down at HMAS Cerberus. Anyhow, what happened then?
So 48, you were married in 48.
Yeah. I continued with the milk round for several years until, because the only milk you could buy those days was from the milkman. And then, of course, bottled milk came in. And I used to have bottled milk. But then it became available everywhere and didn't justify me doing the milk round anymore. So I sold the milk round. And I got a job at Yolumba for 10 years.
You must have known the whole town, did you? Did you know everybody?
Yes. Mm-hmm. From 73 to 83, I worked at Yolumba. During that period of time, in the late, it was 80, we had three children, Peter, John and Dane. And Rosie, we went to a niece's wedding at Boyala. And on the way home, Rosie said to me, "Oh, Rosie, I've got terrible pain in my stomach. Feel to her." I said, "Well, shall we go into Port Pirie Hospital now?" She said, "Let's get home, see the doctor." And home and saw the doctor and took her in the hospital and rang the next day. She said, "Oh, your wife's got cancer in the colon. She'll have to go to town." So I took her to town to, she had an operation and everything was good according to the, and she came home, she was okay. And with that, I was 59. Now I turned 60 in August. This was in March. And I was turning 60 in August. I said, "Look, I've been on the milk round all these years and we've never been away on a decent holiday. I'm going to retire at 60 through war service." You can retire. We can retire. Servicemen could retire at 60 and receive their pension then. So I retired at 60 bought a new car and caravan, and I said, let's go. So I bought it, and we did a trial run up to Paringa, up at Renmark, and back, and looked good, everything was good. And was, this was in August, and then gradually we were getting ready to, you know, getting things organised, and blow me down if she didn't have a, get a good cook again, had to go to hospital, and she died on 9th of December.
Oh.
1983, 58 years old. Wow. And that was a real blow then. I mean, in the meantime, we'd sold our house at Angerston. I bought a house in Bridge Street, and we'd lived down. Rosie got, when she got, we were down here when she got sick, you see, that time. And then went away for a while with my sister and lived in Sydney for about 5 months while trying to get over the death of that. And then I came back and came back to home. But it was a three-bedroom home and big, fairly nice garden, and Rosie was a good garden, but I didn't. I've got a garden. So I decided I'd sell the house, and I bought this unit here in 1997.
So you've been living at this address since 97?
Yeah. And so that's what's happened.
And how old were the children when she passed?
Well, she was 83. The children were about... Jane was early 20s and John and were late 20s and Peter was 30-something. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyhow, now you want to talk about the Navy?
Well, I'm just quickly looking through the notes here. Working as a milkman, firstly, working as a milkman in Angerston, must have been pretty, is a very active, yeah. Very active job.
Oh, yes.
Must have been good for your football.
Oh, yes.
Super fit?
I didn't really have to go training much at footy because I'd be running on the milk ground. I'd start at 2 in the morning after I was doing it on my own and get home at 7 to see the kids go to school and then go and do the town shops and that and then come home at 10 and clean the bucks and all that and then have about a couple of hours sleep and I go to bed at 9 at night and get up again at 2. I had a horse and cart first, you know, and I must tell you I had a sign on the car, a sign on the side of the cart, milk from contented cows. And the butcher up there thought, oh, that's pretty good, right? He was the president of our footy club, Fritz Schultz, who he bought the Schultz's. He said, oh, I'd have something in my butcher shop. So he put a sign in the next day, sausages from pigs that died happy. So I thought, well, I better do better that job than that. So the other side I put, you can whip our cream, but you can't beat our milk. He said, well, I can't forget that one.
So, that's a good insight actually into, you know, early days in the Barossa Valley.
Yeah.
And what about your football? Can you tell me a little bit about your football?
Yes, well,
your footballing days in Angerston.
I played footy for Angerston for how many years? I forget that, but I was captain coach for several years, and
any success with premierships?
No, we only played in one premiership. The reason being that we didn't get, we used to get players from Eden Valley as well, you know, out there, and we had four players from there, they were good players. And then they decided to form our own club out there, so which left us decimated. In those days you couldn't import players and that thing, and so consequently we never won any premiership. We got into a premiership in 1946, and we were about 8 goals up at half time. And my brother Ian, he was going to Concordia College, and he played for Sturt for a bit, and he was playing for us, and he did his knee in at half time. And in the third quarter, our halfback flanker did his ankle in, and the centre halfback got injured too, so we had about 15 players on the ground, and we didn't win the grand final. That was 1946. Otherwise, we would have walked in that.
Who were you playing that day?
Freeling, I think. Anyway, I retired soon after that because I was about 38 or getting up in years. And I played cricket too. I was captain of the cricket club and we won a few premierships there.
This is Angerston,
yes,
as well?
Yes, Angerston. Yep. I made 203 in the final.
Wow.
Mm.
Do you remember it well?
Yes. And
what were your strong shots or your favourite shots?
All round. We had Sir Donald Bradner came up when we had a new turf wicket put in at Angaston, and he came up to open it. And he said, three things you have to remember. Keep your eye on the ball, play a straight bat, and use your feet. And he said, when you get to 50, that's when you really have to start concentrating, so you get to 100, he said. And he did too. I used to watch him play cricket. Sir Donald went down to town and used to listen on the radio when they were in England till 5 o'clock in the morning. Oh, he was a great guy. And his granddaughter, Greta Bradman's on ABC of a Sunday and Saturday. She's got a beautiful voice. And he was quite a good musician too. He played the piano, Sir Donald.
Okay.
Anyway, that happened then. And so when I joined the Navy, went down to Cerberus, HMAS Cerberus, which was a depot down in Melbourne, Dramana down the bottom end of Victoria, near Portsea or Rosebud, and was there for 6 weeks intensive training. And I thought I was pretty fit. And we had to climb up ropes, and which they said, go on, up those ropes and things. And then we had to go learning to row boats, and had a lot of physical training. And after 6 weeks, they said, we want volunteers. There's something new coming up. We can't tell you what it is, but we want volunteers for this particular. So we were left, there's about 100 of us, went to Sydney to the depot there, and we had more training. And then they revealed it was going to be, we'll be trained as coxswains of a landing craft, which takes the troops into the shore, called the HMAS Manura. The Manura, Canimbla and Westralia were, during the war, converted to cruisers to go there. And then those three ships were called back, and they're converted to landing craft ships, carried see all those on this side?
Yep.
And another side, and then there was down there, and there's about 15 on there. We went up to, from Sydney, went up to North Queensland, up to a beach up there with landing craft to exercise, to come into the shore, drop the ramps, and go back again. And we did that for about 2 or 3 months. And then we went back to Sydney when those ships had been ready, converted to go to sea. And then we were attached to the US 7th Fleet.
How did you feel? Do you remember how you felt at this kind of point in time? Was it exciting?
Yes, well, I mean, you didn't know what was going to happen, and felt quite interesting. Anyway, we went to Sydney, and one of the American landing ships joined us to go down to Port Phillip Bay for exercises down there. That's down Victoria. I still remember when the night before we left Sydney, it was pretty windy, and the old petty officer said, boys, he said, it's going to be pretty rough out there. If you haven't been to sea before, you mightn't feel too good. Sure enough, they lined up on the side, spearing away. I was all right till the next day, but I joined them then. But then old P.O. come around and said, come on, boys, you've got to work. You can't be sitting here all day. And he said, if you feel something hairy coming up in your throat, he said, bite it, it's your arsehole. Anyway, we got to Melbourne. After a few days, I got my landing. I felt okay. And having been on these landing craft, you settle down quickly, you know, and I never ever got seasick again.
Okay.
And we did exercises in Port Phillip Bay with an American. And then from there, we went to Cairns and joined the Westralia and Canimbla, which were the other two Australian ships. We were all attached to the US 7th Fleet. From there, we went up to New Guinea. And from there on, we did all those landings. And from there on, which is featured here, we did about 9 landings. Ended up at Manila in the Philippines.
So you're talking here 9 landings in total.
Yes.
What sort of numbers of troops are we talking about each time?
We used to carry about 2,000 troops on each ship. And there was our Australian ships and about 4 other American ships which had same ships. And so there was a big fleet when we were going to all these landings, and we used to lower the landing craft on the side with Davids. I was a coxswain of one of them, in charge of it. And I had a boat's crew and a stoker or engineer to look after the motor. And we used to have about 20 troops come in down the with ropes, you know, they'd come down the rope with all their gear on the back of the landing craft. And of course, you'd be going up and down like that, you know, on the side. And this is okay, it was calm, but sometimes we were about 5 km off the shore, you know, it was the closest you could get. The big ships and soldiers, God, they used to get sick as dogs in the aircraft and said, let's get off of this, we're going to face the Japs. Anyway, at Balikpapan, which was at Borneo, one of them, there was a man in my craft, his name was Lieutenant Tom Derrick, VCDCM. Have you heard of him? Tom Derrick? They got a bridge named after him on Port Adelaide.
Okay, all right.
He was in my landing craft, and I landed him with the other boys up at Tarakan. Unfortunately, he got killed there that time. He was a great guy, you know. I've got a Watching the Gone book where he signed, and my Ian, Andrew, my John, my son's got it, he said, this is valuable. He said, you've got Tom Derrick's name in here and all that, and the other fellows there. And so we had some hairy moments too, I tell you. Jet planes coming at you. And I do remember the closest one we had. While we were going in, behind us we had cruisers bombarding the beach. I still, you know, you can hear the shells going across, you know, those tin hat go off. And so at least when we got to the beach, there was no opposition there because they'd just blown the shit out of the place, you know. It's only when the troops went in further, when they engaged the Japanese, when they really had a tough time, that's where Tom Derrick got killed that time. And when we landed, we used to go in about, I don't know how many times we used to go in before we took all the troops off. You'd come back and you'd go back in again. And then when he'd done the troops, you'd go in with their supplies, you know. And it was usually but we started 5 in the morning and it was usually about 4 in the afternoon by the time we'd finished a landing and the troops were all away and had got all their gear and stuff.
And that's just non-stop?
Yeah.
Non-stop
it was, yeah. And we used to bring injured, wounded soldiers back to the ship. And do you remember a jet plane coming at us? And it's coming straight for our ship. And the gunners on the deck hit it. And it went just behind us and stern and landed in the water, finished up. If that would hit us, we'd have been buggered. But, I mean, we witnessed other ships get sunk, you know, too, you know, jet planes. They'd run straight at them, and they're what you call, what's the name of those?
Kamikaze.
Yeah, kamikazes. Anyway, we ended up at the Philippines and did the landing there. And then we came back, I think, then they asked us if we wanted to continue to serve on the ship. I'd passed my leading seaman exam, and they said to me, look, Ruddy, if you want to continue, we want to go and take troops up to Japan, you know, I said no. I think I'd rather go home because I'll be needed at home. And so I left in 1946, and then I came home. And whilst I was on the ship, I used to be a bugler as well. Of course, I'd started playing in the Angston Town Band before. I'm an ABC Classic FM man. I used to say to the fellows, it's culture you want, not this other stuff you play. Anyway, when I came out, they reformed the band, and my son, John, I got him to come in, and we had Orb Koenig from Tanunda who came up, and he was a leading corner player for Tanunda. They were the top band in Australia at that time. And we started off as D grade and eventually got right up to B grade. And I used to play the cornet, and I used to enjoy playing the music. And I also sang in the choir, Gawler Bros Oratorio Choir, and we went on tours down the southeast.
Your face lit up when you started talking about music.
Yeah.
So music obviously has been a big part of your life.
Yeah.
And can you tell me and elaborate a little bit more on the groups you played in and some of your performance experiences?
Yeah, well, I played in the Hankston Town Band, and we performed, took part in the Tanunda Band competitions every year. We had bands from everywhere come here. Like I said, we started off at B grade and ended up at B grade. But then, of course, fellas left and moved away, and the band went into recession, and they thought of no more band. I still got an instrument there. I pull it every now and again and give it a bit of a blow.
Would you?
Oh, well, I don't know. My lips are not that good anymore.
How many years have you had this instrument?
Oh, I reckon about 60 years.
Do you pull this out?
Not that often. Every now and again I pull it out but they wanted me to join the band down here, but I couldn't march anymore, you know. And well, I couldn't march, but I've been taking part in the, I used to go down Anzac Day every day to town and march with the boys who were on the ship. When it got down, there's only three of us left. And I didn't go down last year for the first time. My kids said to me, Dad, my daughter Jane said, Dad, you can go next year and you're in the wheel and I'll wheel you down there. I said, oh, I don't know, I'll do that or not, I said. I'm missing my faith in my Lord that got me through, I think, a lot of these things. Because I used to think, well, you never walk alone when you walk with God.
Did your faith help you during the times in service in action? Was it something that would, you know, keep you strong?
Yeah, well, I say, well, look, I'm in the Lord's hands and whatever happens, that's His will. So I guess, you know, it's supported me, I think.
When you left the service in 1946, did you keep in touch many of your comrades?
Oh yes, I went over to Melbourne a few times for annual thing, and they still send me letter, you know, about who's still alive and where they sort of meet, but the numbers are getting very small at the moment now, you know, as you could imagine. I mean, I'm 96, and so not too many around anymore.
You're 96 years of age. How old do you feel?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, you can't really calculate how old you feel. I mean, when you were younger, you felt a lot different to what you do now. I mean, my feet are playing up a bit. I can't walk that far, although I got a new pair of shoes with the doctor recommend. I get them that breathe a bit more with on your feet, and so I only got them last week. So I walked up the street and I go steady, and I try to go for a walk each day around the block here, which is supposed to be good for you anyway. So I do that.
Do you kind of have a fairly healthy diet?
Yes, I do all my own cooking. I eat what's recommended, you know. I don't drink much alcohol. I'll have a beer with John and that, but I'm not a teetotaler, but I just don't think alcohol is good for you. That's what some time ago, now about 4 or 5 years ago, I had a bit of a heart murmur, evidently. So a heart specialist came to Gawler, and it's a woman, and And she said, "Roddy, your blood pressure's good for your age." She said, it's nearly as good as a young man, which is a good thing. So I'll give you a heart tablet, two heart tablets to take daily for blood thinners, so you don't get a clot, which I've been doing about 4 or 5 years ago now. And the last time I went down, no, the previous time I went down, she said, "Oh, there's no change." She said, "I'll take you off one of those tablets. You just take one tablet now," which I'm doing. And the last time I went down this year in March, she said, "No difference, you're okay. I don't want to see you again unless you want to see me." And I had an operation. What's it?
What was the operation? What type of operation?
You know, here for...
Prostate?
Yeah, prostate. This is now about, quite a few years ago. And they said they... nothing serious, but... so I'm on a tablet every day for that. And it has helped, but... another thing I did after I came out of the Navy, after my wife had died, John, my son and daughter-in-law, just lived up 4 houses from where I was in Bridge Street. And I used to go up there in the morning and do their dishes and so forth. John was a physio and his wife was a teacher at the college out here. So I'd do a bit of dishes and clean up a bit and prune their roses. And during one of those days, Tim Linus, who was a Ford dealer down here, his son married one of my sister's daughters. So I got to know the Linuses pretty well. And Tim said to me, "What are you doing?" "Oh," I said, "I'm doing a bit of gardening and doing the dishes." I said, "Why?" "Well," he said, "I need someone to help me in the business to pick up, drive cars and pick up customers' cars for service or any other jobs I got. Would you be interested?" I said, "Yep." So I did that for 20 years for him. About 2 years ago now or more, he sold the business to Monteam's. And Monteam guys I'd met a few times through Tim, and they said, "Roddy, we'd like you to continue with us because you know where to go in town. You don't even have to take a directory there. Go to pick up parts and cars all over the suburbs, everywhere." And they said, "But you'll be on wages." I said, "No bloody way." I said, I was lost, you know, after driving every day for him. During that period of time, Toyota were opposite Tim, and Gordon Aldersley, the manager, often used to say to me, "Roddy, are you going to town?" And Gordon said to me, Gordon's mum and dad used to do driving for them. And then his mother died and his father ended up in the home and said, "Can you help us out?" So I'm doing a bit for them. That's so each year you get your paper from the rego, and I go to the doctor. I says to the doctor, "I've got to have, you know, fill this out, and you've got to sign it, and whether I'm able to drive anymore." And I get all ticks, and now she said, "This is the big test, your eyesight." And they put up the thing, and I can read down about 4 lines without glasses. And so I've passed every year so far, and I haven't been in any accidents, so up till now I've received my license. I don't even have to do a physical test, so I'm still happy I'll never do it this year.
So do you drive every day, or every few days?
Oh, in my car I go, sometimes I go to Gawler and do a bit of shopping, but I mean with the restrictions or anything, I haven't been doing much driving. I go up to Katina to see my daughter, she lives at Katina. I haven't been up there since the COVID thing's on because they said there's no point in going anyway if you don't have to, they said to me.
I have to ask, in all of your years driving, have you ever had an accident?
One. I was coming down from Lindock through, what's the name of it?
Jacob's Creek.
Jacob's Creek, over that bridge. And I was bringing back a new car. And I was doing about 90 or whatever it was, less than that. And I thought, well, will I pass that car or not? No, I thought, no, I pulled in behind and I put my foot on the brake and one of the wheels must have locked and started bouncing around and I couldn't control it. And it went up further and we did a right-hand turn and flipped it over. And I was upside down. My cap fell off my head. But I didn't get injured or anything. But that's the only, I mean, it was, wasn't really an accident. It was, and then I said, when Tim came, he said, oh, what the hell have you been doing? I said, come here. And took him back and could see that mark where the tyre, the brake had locked. And you could see the black skid mark on one wheel, which caused that, you know. I didn't react quickly enough instead of grabbing the handbrake, which would put the black wheels on, but there was other cars coming too, you see. And fortunately, when I went across the road on and did a right-hand turn and ended up upside down, there was a car coming this way. Fortunately, it wasn't that close. And they all came rushing over, and I crawled out with the, and I said, I've lost my cap. But I didn't get injured. Matter of fact, in the afternoon, I went to Gawler, went to Manham with John. He had a deliverer. He had a boat down there. He wanted to drive it up to Swan Reach, and he said, drive my car down and then come up and pick me up. So I didn't get injured.
What age were you when this happened?
Oh, I suppose I'd have been about 70. A few people have backed into me in shopping centres and things like that, you know. I got a little Jazzy and a Honda Jazzy, a good little car, and someone must have dented my back with a
trolley.
Yeah.
Shopping trolley.
Yeah. Otherwise, no, I've had a good run with that regard.
So you've lived in the Barossa Valley, really, pretty well all your life.
Yes.
You just must know so many people here in the Barossa.
Oh, yes, I know. Heaps of them. I mean, through involvement in sport, singing. But of course, I mean, since I've been about 90, I haven't been involved much, you know, with any other people, you know, much really. And now with this COVID thing, you know, I've been in isolation. About 2 weeks ago, my daughter-in-law used to come and say, Ruddy, you're not to go out. I'll do all your shopping for you if you want anything and that. And so I was sort of isolated here for a couple of weeks all on my own. And I'd go for a walk around, that sort of thing, that's all. But this last week I've been going up and doing my own shopping.
Can I ask you, Roddy, what are your thoughts on the state of the planet at the moment with COVID-19 and all the rioting that's happening in America right now? What are your thoughts on the state of the world today?
Well, it's a sign of the times. Because it said in the Bible, before the end comes, there'll be wars and rumors of wars. Nations are going to fight against nations. There'll be earthquakes and floods and that. And all these things are coming to place now, you know. You think about those things, you know. Because the end of the world's going to come sometime. And the way things have gone over in the States, what the heck?
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
I mean, I don't blame him for kicking up a thing because that policeman stood on that fellow's bloody neck and killed him. And we come over the news this morning, he died from asphyxiation. It wasn't from any other reason. So. Mm. But, I mean, you can't just go bloody berserk. And my brother-in-law, John Sheridan, was in the Navy too. And then he was a prisoner, when he was in Singapore, they were taken prisoner of war there by the Japs, you know. The ship had been sunk. And he was in the Changi camp. And he said to me, Roddy, that was terrible. He doesn't like to talk about it, but whilst they were there, because the British battleships got sunk there, and one of the fellows was a medical officer who was in with them, he said, and they were dying like flies. And one day the medical officer said, look, there's these capsicums, something like that. There was all these growing out, we said where they were, and the officer said, let's eat some of these two or three times a day. and he said that helped them survive. And they end up they were living, eating 10 a day. They're not capsicums, they're sharp, they're oh, I remember. Anyway, he planted three of them out the back of his place after he come home. He ate them, yeah. After the war, he and his about 10 of his mates went back on a tour of the camp where they were. And he said the prison's still there, and they've got Indian Gurkhas as guards on the prison. And he said above each cell on the door is the name of the prisoner and the number of lashes they get. And he said, that guy said, they don't reoffend after that. That's what these kids should be getting, lashes. Yeah, he said, they don't reoffend after that.
All these years have passed since you were in the Navy. Did you ever go back to any of these countries?
No.
Never returned?
No, I didn't have any desire to do it, really. Went to Darwin, because after the war we called in there and took some civilians from Darwin back to Indonesia. When we got to Darwin, the place was a wreck. They bombed the shit out of it. And Australia didn't know about it. They weren't told, were they? You wouldn't remember that, would you? No. And they sunk ships in the harbour, and the Japs bombed the place to buggery, you know. And you couldn't believe it until you saw it.
So that was kept from the greater Australian public?
Yep.
Yeah.
They didn't. And they just talked about there was raids on Darwin, but there was nothing mentioned of what the devastation it caused. Oh, we went around, we couldn't believe it. And that's about the only, and after the war, I drove up to Darwin with Katie after we were first married. We drove to Darwin for a trip and went up around there. And we also drove up around that area where Roger's father was. We were never, never. We were the quiet stockmen up there, and went to the place where Elsie Station was called. And Mrs. Gunn, who wrote a book, We of the Never Never, she was up there. And they've still got that place there as a, they've got, it's a historical place where people go visiting. And we called in there, and then we went to this room, and they started talking about it. And I said, excuse me, I said, can I say something? They said, yeah. I said, well, I married the daughter of the quiet stockman. Oh, they said, yeah. I said, yeah. It was Rosie, you see. And John, my son, he got to know Rosie's dad. He had a bike shop at Angus, and after he come back from up that area there, he was a crack shot, rifle shot, because I still remember Rosie saying to me, Dad never had to buy a turkey or a goose for Christmas or Easter. He'd win all those. They used to have rifle shots, and he'd win every one. They never had to buy a turkey or a goose. He was such a good crack shot.
Wow, you've had a very, very interesting life. You've certainly done a lot of different things, yeah. Roddy. Can I perhaps just ask you a little bit about your childhood days in the Barossa Valley? And you grew up on a farm,
yeah.
At St. Kitts,
yeah.
You mentioned. Was Barossa Deutsch, was that spoken in the house?
Yes, we used to speak German. Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't remember much, you know, but we could understand it. And Dad's father used to be, my grandfather, I'd never met him because he died before I was born out there. And they used to have German services in church and English. And of course we went to school and we were all English. We didn't speak any German at school, you see. Edward Francis Farrell, he was a teacher, and he was an excellent teacher, and taught us. He was very, very musical too, you know. And that's where we got all our music from, I think, initially, though. They used to sing and form the choir and everything up there at the school. And we used to put on annual, have our choir singing.
And whereabouts would those performances happen?
In St. Kitts.
St. Kitts.
Yeah, they had a place down the bottom there alongside the church, which was sort of a big hall, and we used to have an annual break-up.
Were you ever involved with Liedertafel?
No, Robert Homburg said to me when I came to Tanunda, he said, "Roddy, what about doing the Liedertafel? We can do with it." "Yep, I've heard you singing tenor voice in St. Paul's," he said. "No," I said, "Robert," I said, "I've got other things going now," and I said, "I don't feel that I could spend another night away at home, you know, I'd rather just relax." And so I didn't never join the Liedertafel. I could have, but felt it wasn't.
I take it then you would have known Carl Rodefeld fairly well?
Yeah, he was the bandmaster of Maranga Brass Band.
That's my mother's father?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, so Carl was my grandfather?
Yeah, he used to conduct the Maranga Brass Band. I can remember one year when they were competing, I don't think Angston were competing, and whether I helped them play one year in the Maranga Band, just for the contest. And Alicia Schutz, who used to play for them, and she's now playing for the Tanunda Band, and she was a top tenor horn player when she was at Maranga. And then she went on a tour to England and played with many bands there. And while she was over there, she met her husband in Sweden, I think. Then she was playing the cornet when she come back here. She's a leading cornet player in the Tanunda Town Band. I know she did an interview with me here one day.
So what year were you with the football club?
I was in the team of the century in 1900, the selected one. And the 125th anniversary of the celebration of the club. And they've got players from all that time. And I was a reserve.
What was your normal position on the field?
I used to play centre or on the ball. Anywhere.
Anywhere, yeah.
All over the place.
Who was the rival team back in those days?
Tanunda, Hiliopa, and Kapunda, Freeling.
Liga,
Clyde. Yeah.
Could you just say what it was, sorry, for the recording, Roddy? You had a nickname.
The reason I was called Nigger, we all used to sunbake, you know, on the decks. And I had the best sunbake. I was really dark. It got dark. And one fella they called 2359. And another fella was called Midnight. And they called me Nigger. Because we had the three best tans. There's 11 in our family, and everyone reached 80.
Wow. There's something in the genes.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Dad was born in 1887. Mum was born in 1891. And they both died in 1966. Mum in August 66 and Dad in November 1966.
Whereabouts, where are they buried?
In Angston.
Angston, yeah. Mm-hmm. So your ancestors came out to the Barossa in 1858?
Mm. From down Polnitz way, it's down near the border of Poland, you know.
Silesia?
Yeah, Silesia, down there. That's where most of the people came from who were in the Barossa. Silesia area there, down there, yeah.
I'd like to say, Roddy Kleinig, thank you very much for talking with me today. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Yeah, good to meet you too.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.